This year, the Society for Theatre Research held its annual Theatre Book Prize Awards ceremony at the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane, last Tuesday, the 7th of April. Actor-director Stephen Berkov will announce the winner, but first an overview of the theatre books published in the calendar year 2008 from the judges. Here's the book prize organiser, Howard Loxton, in the Grand Saloon at Drury Lane.
It's great to be here again this year, and the Society for Theatre Research is grateful to Really Useful Theatres for inviting us back, and to their staff for their assistance. We also have to thank De Winters for providing us with some elegant invitations. But even more, I have to thank my team of indefatigable judges, Professor Kate Newey, Omar Oke, and Ian Shuttleworth, and also the publishers who entered the books and the authors who wrote them, because there wouldn't be any point in having this prize without them, would there? We didn't have quite so many to read this year. Actually, just under 60. That's a little more than one a week, after all. I mean, it's easy. Except that most of them arrived after October, and that does rev up the pace. I can't claim that we read each one of them from cover to cover. Certainly I didn't. But we did make sure that they all got very serious attention, and they did all get at least read far enough to know that we weren't going to make that the winner. and that's quite a long way in, I do assure you. among the joys of the job are the surprises of what tickles a particular judge's fancy. No revelations, but I long since gave up trying to predict which book was going to win. They certainly had a very eclectic batch to choose from in 2008, as you can see from the display. In a moment, the judges are going to talk about their shortlist and some of their other choices, but I'd like to mention a few others just to show the whole range, which went from, ways in which medieval theatre was staged to modern British musicals in New York and in London. Biographies ranged from Jonathan Crowell's carefully researched fat volume on the great and much-loved Sybil Thorndike from House to a slim paperback on Ira Aldridge. Martin Hoyle's little book from Hansib offers no new research to make it a real contender for the prize, but it would be useful for introducing young people to an icon of Black British culture. Autobiographies from living stars included intriguing glimpses of Julie Walters' early years at Liverpool Everyman in That's Another Story from Weidenfeld, while Christopher Biggins gave us plenty of giggles in Just Biggins from John Blake, along with Crave Revel Horwood's Glittering Balls from Michael O'Mara. And I personally particularly enjoyed Lee Lawson's memoir, The Dream, an Actor's Story from Oberon, which, of course, is built around his experiences of working on that play. From an American academic press, Iowa, came a study of the making of reputations in London theatre, while from Bristol, Intellect sent us Bringing Down the House, Olivia Turnbull's study of the closures brought by funding problems among British theatres. And Cambridge University Press sent us Shakespeare's Globe, a collection of essays that record and reflect on the experiments in original practices at the Southwark Playhouse. The Globe is famous enough to attract a major publisher, but the history of our provincial theatres often relies upon the small independent publishers and local presses. It's not often that they end up prize winners, but they do a valuable job in putting things on permanent record that would otherwise be hard to find. This year, for instance, we had Ian Schlieter's, if I pronounce his name correctly, book on the Palace Theatre Watford from Atlantic Publishing, Graham Smith's on the Theatre Royal Glasgow from Glasgow Publications, and the Society for Theatre Research itself co-published Don Chapman's Oxford Playhouse with Hertfordshire University Press. The Society's own publication programme was established to make available those titles that might otherwise never get into print, and all members automatically receive them as part of their subscription. But before I'm tempted to start a full-blown commercial for STR, I'm going to hand over to the judges. I'm glad to say they never came to blows over their decisions, and though we did end up with one more on the shortlist than the official number, I never had to use my casting vote. First, then, I give you director and choreographer Omar Oke.
Morning. Good morning. You're all very serious, aren't you, up there? We had a really hard task ahead of us, sorting out the one book we thought was the out-and-out winner. But it's not very easy, is that? It's because it's the vast part of the books that we were sent, there were so many that deserved to be, they should have won. They all should have won. But Howard said to us no, and pick one, so we bowed to Howard. The first one, Transnational Exchange in Early Modern Theatre, from Ashgate, is a collection of essays edited by Robert Henke and Eric Nicholson. I found the discussion between the theatrical borders, nationalities, and the way the foreign influences helped develop English theatre interesting. But it also showed perhaps Shakespeare's ideas were not so original after all. Maybe he did maybe get his ideas from other places. That's okay. Ballet in the Blitz is a posthumous autobiography by Mona Inglesby. To me, it's a real find being a dancer. Put together from existing material by Kay Hunter and published by Groundnut Publishing, another of those really small publishers Howard was talking about earlier. I think it provides great insight into the early years of touring ballet companies, something which is taken for granted now, but international ballet, despite having a very tiny budget, brought the classical dance to the masses and cut out all that stupid snobbery, which I think really prevails today. I think it deserves its place in dance schools, libraries, just because it's historical references. On the other hand, Bloomsbury Ballerina by Judith McCarroll, published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson, fell a little bit short of the mark for me. It did not really give enough insight to the life of Lydia Lopakova or the world-famous Ballet Russe, in which she rose to become its prima ballerina. Now, being a dancer myself, I found it a little bit well-wanting. The Golden Generation, edited by Dominic Shellard and published by the British Library, is made up of articles and interviews by those involved in the Theatre Oral History Project, which the British Library has been running in partnership with Sheffield University. It focuses on interviews from people who've worked in almost every aspect of the theatre from 1945 to 1968. Now, a large part of it gives a great insight into the development of the Theatre Royal Stratford East in London, a place in which I've actually had a lot of pleasure to work and a lot of fun there as well. But also to the Fringe and the West End. The interviews are frank, they're funny, and sometimes they're very, very raw, but they're honest, giving knowledge and inspiration. I believe for anyone who may be already treading the board or mad enough to want to start. It also connects with television and how that shaped the way we work in performance today. Takes me on to The Sound of Theatre by David Collison, published by Plaza. Also deals with TV and theatre. Little link there. Did you like that? No? I'll carry on. Anyway, this book is a must, I think, for anybody training in that technical side of things in live performance. I always think sound is sometimes, it's overlooked in theatre. We have dance and everything else, and sound's overlooked. It's a very neat book showing the early use of sound right up to the high-tech rock concerts and the demands on now made of a good sound engineer. But, of course, in some shows, they can't always work miracles. One book I had a real affection for and that I feel allows the new generation of theatre-goers to express their life and needs, mainly in this time in the world, worries, it seems, is Verbatim Verbatim by Oberon. That's my personal favourite, I think. Its editors, Will Hammond and Dan Stewart, interviewed many of the people who have been creating and, well, what we now come to call verbatim theatre. I've seen quite a few pieces over the last few years by young performers, writers and directors, and they all seem to use this form of theatre to react to what is happening now in the present, which they feel needs to be told. It gives a clear, uninterrupted, honest dialogue for the new voice of theatre. Well, that's me. I've gabbled on, probably too long. Thanks for listening. Hope you liked it. What?
Did you like the kilt?
Now, Howard said to me, wear the kilt for a bit of eye candy. So I did. So I'll say thank you. And now I'd like to give you Ian Shuttleworth and Kate Newey. Oh, Kate Newey first. My mistake. Good morning. Lots of love. Kate Newey.
Thanks, Omar. This year's entries to the Society for Theatre Research Book Prize yielded a rich harvest of books about Irish theatre. And before I go on to talk about the two shortlisted books, I wanted to mention some of the other books we've read, which offer new readings of Irish theatre. Eugene McNulty's The Irish Literary Theatre, published by Cork University Press. Paul Murphy's Hegemony and Fantasy in Irish Drama, 1899-1949, published by Palgrave Macmillan. And Ronald Souchard's book on Yeats and the Celtic Revival, called The Last Minstrel, published by Oxford University Press. I was particularly struck by this range of new research and writing about Irish theatre, and I wondered, possibly somewhat unsophisticatedly and unsubtly, whether the recent peace process has enabled theatre scholars, amongst others, to revisit long-held assumptions about Anglo-Irish relations with new energy and new thought and new independence, in fact. I have to say, though, and I expressed this to Howard at the start of the process, that I had some doubts about what felt to me to be a rather imperialist notion that a prize for books about British theatre could actually include books about Irish theatre. But actually, I thought the continuing analysis of the relationship between Ireland and mainland Britain is still one of the drivers of interest in and one of the knots to unpick in the history of Irish theatre. And having lived in Australia for some time, I'm quite acutely aware of the ways in which the old British Empire still affects its subjects and former subjects, although Australians are still British subjects, in the 21st century. And now I think we're seeing some of those former subjects speaking back to empire and the imperial centres. On the topic of theatre and national culture, I just wanted to mention two other books. Amelia Kritzer's work, Political Theatre in Post-Thatcher Britain, and Steve Wilmer's collection of essays from across Europe, National Theatres in a Changing Europe, both published by Palgrave Macmillan. And both books, which look at the way that theatre responds so quickly and so concretely to political change. And I think all of us in this room know that of all the arts, theatre is possibly the most responsive to those changes and textures of our everyday lives. So, to the two shortlisted books that it's my pleasure to say something about. I found reading Bill MacDonald's book, Bill MacDonald's book, Theatres of the Troubles, published by University of Exeter Press, a really moving experience in reading that book. I think it's an object lesson in how to write about recent events and the people who lived through them within a broader historical frame. Bill's combination of shrewd analysis after the event, archival work, and his vivid descriptions of working and performing in and with the Belfast and Derry communities is always compelling. And I think he's succeeded in offering a very personal account within a work of deep research and thoughtful analysis. In this day, when we think we're sick of politics, he also writes of political action through theatre and reminds us how much the big questions, which we might think are out of reach for us to change, do affect our lives. And he reminds us that we can be involved in that change. I think this book is a handbook for political theatre activists everywhere, not just Ireland. I don't think my fellow judges will mind me saying that we were all quite surprised at our unanimous, and indeed all of the shortlisted books were unanimous nominations, but our unanimous nomination of Patrick Lonergan's book, Theatre and Globalisation, published by Palgrave Macmillan again. Each of us around the lunch table, we do the judging by a series of quite convivial lunches, refereed by Howard. But each of us recounted how we picked it up, expecting rather difficult concepts expressed in highly technical language of economics and political theory, with not much to speak to any of us as working theatre practitioners or scholars. Only to find that each of us, in our different ways, was quite gripped by the book. For me, it spoke to so much of what is current in theatre as an industry, and indeed reinforces what I've always said as a theatre historian. I'm one of those pesky historians who said, yes, it's been happening all the time, that theatre always has been a globalised international industry. We stand here in one of the centres of that industry, in fact. Lonergan discusses the ways in which Irish theatre is a textbook example of an apparently unique local national culture, marketed internationally. I only have to mention Martin McDonagh there for people to understand that kind of odd paradox. He introduces sophisticated ideas with clarity and humour and identifies the ways in which all of us think about the global and the local at the same time. I found, and I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, I found that the week after reading this book, I was already quoting his arguments to my students. Properly footnoted. I know that what he has to say about the processes and results of the globalisation of Irish theatre will keep me thinking for some time to come. And I'll hand over to the final judge, Ian Shuttleworth.
As a Northern Irishman on the twin thresholds of Britishness and Irishness, I perhaps understandably felt it politic to leave the entire Irish question to the Anglo-Welsh Australian on the panel. Instead, reporting on the recent opening of the Victoria and Albert Museum's new theatre and performance galleries, David Lister in The Independent affected surprise at the breadth of coverage. He had never, he claimed, realised that what Pete Townshend had been doing in his guitar-smashing days was theatre. Apart from suggesting that he either hadn't read or hadn't understood the words "and performance," David was ignoring one of the principal components that make rare performers and performances so compelling. This is the territory covered by Jane Goodall in her book Stage Presence from Routledge. She not only surveys various historical and philosophical concepts such as genius, mesmerism, drawing power, and so forth, but takes as her examples individuals ranging from the theatrical pantheon, such as Garrick, Keane, Irving, and Brando, through scientific or pseudo-scientific figures like Mesmer and Nikola Tesla, to the likes of David Bowie, Johnny Rotten, and even Edna Everidge. Goodall also explores the cross-fertilization between lexicons of poetry and science, of performer, performance, and audience, and of the immediate moment and timelessness. After reading her book, we may scarcely be any nearer a taxonomy or a quantitative approach to this mysterious quality. Charisma, magnetism, and a host of other terms have signified components of the idea. But we do have a much more complete sense of what it is that we're groping towards and the numerous areas in which we're doing the groping. Goodall's investigation covers not only the sense itself, but also accounts of the phenomenon and the usually only partial ways in which they convey an impression of this elusive property according to the background from which a particular perspective emerges. Some accounts, however inadequate they may be to conveying the entirety of the experience, still sound down the ages. I was recently asked what I would choose if I could travel anywhere at any time to see any piece of theatre. To my immense surprise, after reading this year's award submissions, I found myself answering that my wish would be to see Henry Irving performing The Bells. The production, which seems to have been considered to be the greatest dramatic realisation of his personal powers, notwithstanding the perhaps less than epochally meritorious material. Irving is, on the one hand, a towering icon, and on the other, an indication of how rapidly living memory passes into historical mystique. It's less than two ordinary lifetimes since his heyday, but any feeling sense of his performance has by now been diluted and pressed into the ink of scholarly pages. Richard Folk's book, Henry Irving, A Reevaluation of the Preeminent Victorian Actor-Manager from Ashgate, is a useful contemporary summation of the actor's career and reputation. But it was its misfortune to appear in the same batch of award candidates as Michael Holroyd's A Strange Eventful History, The Dramatic Lives of Ellen Terry, Henry Irving, and Their Remarkable Families from Chatto and Windus. As Goodall testifies, the individual charismatic performer is a perennial subject of examination, witness not least our illustrious guest today. Holroyd, however, expands his focus from Irving and Terry, either individually or as a couple on and off stage. The multiple biography is a slippery enough project to pull off, even when considering a conventional nuclear lineal family. How much more awkward, then, when considering the lives, extended families and relationships of Irving and Terry, not simply blood relatives such as Terry's son, Edward Gordon Craig, but lovers like Edward William Godwin, the father of Craig, and his sister Edie. In the field of biography, Holroyd is, of course, one of the governors. He combines sedulous research with an immensely readable style, with the result that his subjects seem that much more immediate to us. A similar immediacy is achieved by Peter Gill's slim essay-cum-memoir Apprenticeship from Oberon, in which he accompanies a personal tour d'horizon of the theatrical vista in the watershed period of the late 1950s, early 60s, with annotated extracts from his own rehearsal diaries at the time of William Gaskell's 1962 RSC production of Brecht's The Caucasian Short Circle. It's that combination of individual perspective, immediacy, and hindsight, which takes territory that has been ploughed so many times before and refertilizes it. A whole package of brief investigations, 31 in all, arranged alphabetically from Bergman to Zeffirelli, are contained in the Routledge Companion to Directors Shakespeare, in which editor John Russell Brown asks his contributors each to consider a handful of specific productions by their respective subjects. In a period when the decentering of the text is, some might argue belatedly, gaining ground in British theatre, it's heartening to find that, in a way, the work of Shakespeare still constitutes a lingua franca for practitioners ranging from Yukio Ninagawa to Robert Lepage, and from Max Reinhardt to Barry Rutter. But in choosing our shortlist, which we decided unusually to expand to 6 titles from 5, it was Goodall's and Holroyd's books which seemed to us to contribute more to our understanding and appreciation of theatre.
To announce the prize and present it to the winner, I'm delighted to introduce someone who couldn't be more appropriate for that job, because he's a published poet, a short story writer, an autobiographer, and a writer of books on theatre. Oh, quite apart from being a director, a producer, and an actor. He's currently having a great success appearing in that other Theatre Royal in the Haymarket in his own amazing production of On the Waterfront. Stephen Berkoff.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much, and thank you as well for that wonderful and warm-hearted introduction to me, which I felt was very flattering and also very nourishing to us poor performers working in this very difficult industry. It's been fascinating to be here today and to hear these very eloquent, very articulate summaries of these wonderful books, and how valuable are books on the living arts, particularly on the theatre. Because theatre, particularly for someone like myself, that part of myself that's still an actor, acting is so ephemeral, and sometimes we see and hear of these great performances, and acting in the theatre is like the snow that comes, and it's very beautiful, then it melts away. And we need those witnesses, those scribes, who are able to see the performance and convey the power, the magic, and the integrity, if you like, of that performance. And not only that, that they have this extraordinary skill to go back in time and resurrect, almost from the dead, the performances of Henry Irving or Garrick, or particularly Edmund Kean. And we need these people, we need these books in the theatre, because theatre is like the snow. It melts away unless you have occasional videos, which are never like the real thing. And so we cannot appreciate these writers enough. And I myself, when I used to read books in the theatre, I almost relived the performances of, say, Edmund Kean, written by that great biographer Giles Playfair, or reading the excerpts from Hazlitt's description of Kean as if playing Shakespeare as if by strokes of lightning. And you could almost get the feeling of what it was like then to have seen him. Or even Kenneth Tynan, a most marvelous and skilled describer of the living event, when he writes about Olivier as Oedipus, that the screen had the rafter of the new theatre in St. Martin's Lane trembling, and it is trembling still to this very time. And a friend of mine actually went into the theatre to check that. And apparently it is. There is a slight draft from the window that, which is up near the attic, and it gives a kind of tremble. But those kind of descriptions are hyperboles, but they emphasize the love we have for the living art and the love we must have for the actor, who is often, in a way, not exactly abused, but made a servant of the director and of the writer, all very important people. But the actor's work dissolves. It's here for a moment, and then it dissolves. The playwright can have his books being read and reread and republished ad infinitum. And so these people who write these books are really, for me and for everyone else, absolutely valuable. So I will finish now, having very, very proud to be here in this great theatre, which was, in fact, ruled by Edmund Kean in the 1820s and 30s, where Kean gave some of his most fantastic performances. And, of course, one of his giant performances was in Othello. People used to see his Othello and just gasp and sometimes faint. So you can imagine what we are being deprived of today with a political correctness. However, enough of that. I'm here to announce the winner, and I'd like to announce the winner and make just a comment. It's the Irish drama In the Celtic Tiger Era by Patrick Lonergan. And a remarkable study of Irish theatre. And most of us in England, particularly theatre people, we're very, in a way, we're very nationalistic. I mean, what's pertinent to London, to England, really is all we really care about. And sometimes the odd foreign play will come across, which we'll pay a little bit of respect to, and, you know, occasionally Irish. So this book is so important because it tells us what is going on in Ireland, and it actually is overwhelming to read the sheer variety, the diversity, the sheer genius of the writers and actors and the passion of the Irish theatre. Now, as we all do, there's something I must confess. It's a habit, perhaps a bad habit, but when I pick up a theatre book, I tend to go to the back to look up the index. I can't help it. I just to see where is B, 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 and then it's, oh, it's Brecht, Bergman, Bond, where's Barkov's? No, there. And I'm used to that. I put up with it, you know, being vetoed. But with this particular book, wonderful, wonderful book, I looked up the back, and I tell you why. I have a very special relationship with Ireland, specifically Dublin. I've worked there. I did one of my first plays, Greek, at the Project Theatre Dublin, which was received very well, very warm-heartedly by the people of Ireland. And then a short visit at the Gate Theatre to do Decadence. And then Michael Colgan, then the director, and still the director, irascible, charming, aggressive, interesting, and Irishman. He said, in 1928, when the Gate started, they started with Michael McLeamore. And he said, we want to start, this is Irish theatre, we want to show the Brits something, we'll start with the most dynamic theatre programme. And it was. They started their season in 1928 with Eugene O'Neill's A Hairy Ape, a phenomenal play, of course, never done here. Oscar Wilde's Salome, again, never done here, and Peer Gynt. It was a sensational beginning to an incredible season, which launched the gate, which got it going, which developed its reputation and attracted people like Orson Welles. Well, in 88, when I was in Ireland doing a little bit of touring, Colgan said, I'd like to revive that 28th season with The Hairy Ape and Peer Gynt and Salome. And I said, this is amazing. I've been wanting to do Salome and The Hairy Ape all my life. I find these are two of the most powerful, passionate, brilliantly written plays. And he said, that's perfect. We'll start with Salome. And we did. And I had an extraordinary cast. Just happened to be available at the time. A man called Alan Stanford, who is an honorary Irishman. He's actually English, but lives in Ireland. Couldn't get work here. And Owen Fuery. Perfect Herod and Salome. An extraordinary musician. Sometimes there's a combination of elements that brings it together, and it's not just the vision of the director. It is also the actors, the chemistry between all. This production of Salome, and I only mention it, and I'd never like to blow my trumpet, was received with absolute euphoria by the press of Ireland, by every single paper. It created a sensation in Ireland in 1988. It was astonishing. Went to the Edinburgh Festival in 89. Then I recast and we did it again at the National Theatre. Went to New York. The Irish company themselves went to Spoleto. It travelled the world. Then it was revived, not once, not twice, three and four times. It was the undiscovered jewel of Oscar Wilde. His most amazingly written, most rhapsodic, most poetic play is never done. Anyway, we did it. And it is not mentioned once in this book. So, I always think there's something behind that. That's my, you know, paranoia. But I hope that when it's reprinted, and it will be, because it is such an informative and fascinating book, that he might just add a little bit. So this is for the clever and wonderful Patrick Lonergan, published by Palgrave Macmillan.
Are you Patrick Lonergan? Yes. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I suppose I know what my next book has to be about now. I'm really astonished. I honestly didn't expect to get this award. I'm delighted and honored to have done so. This is my first book, so to be honest, it's actually a surprise that it's even been read by four people who aren't related to me. So thank you very much for that. And thanks also for your comments, which I appreciate a lot. I think you're right about what you say about the peace process and how that has enabled Irish and British scholars to look again at the richness of the relationship between our two countries. I mean, I had a very nice moment walking along these streets this morning, thinking about the ghost of Richard Brinsley Sheridan, an Irishman who I think haunts these streets and perhaps this theatre as well. So it is a very rich relationship, and it means a lot to me to receive this award. I'd like very quickly just to say a few thank yous, if you don't mind. Particularly, I'd like to thank my publishers, Palgrave Macmillan, who are wonderful to work with. They produce beautiful books that are a delight to hold and to muck about with, and to read, most importantly. I really appreciate all of the work that Christabel, Scaife, Paula Kennedy, and Stephen Hall did on the book, which benefited me enormously. I'd like also to thank my colleagues in my home university, National University of Ireland, Galway. I suppose it's one of these centres of excellence, I think, is the term that might be used here, although we don't use that formality ourselves. But it's a place where there are a lot of people who are very passionately dedicated to the theatre, to the liveness of theatre, to writing about theatre. And it's a great place to work, and my colleagues have contributed a great deal to my work and to my happiness as well, professionally speaking. I'd like to thank particularly my family, my wife, Therese, and my daughter, Saoirse. And finally, just thank you very much to the Society for this honour. It's a terrific surprise. Very much appreciated. And thank you also to the judges.